Diane. Great to be with you. On My Mind this week, President Trump says he's invited Vladimir Putin to visit the White House in the fall. This came as news to the nation's top intelligence officer, who heard about it from a reporter. That was just the latest development in a week that started in Helsinki, where the president undermined his intelligence agencies on foreign soil. Some called this treason. Then we saw him backtrack, and then flip-flop on his backtrack. So I invited a former CIA officer to join me to get a sense of what this week looked like from the point of view of the intelligence community.
Donald Trump is a walking textbook for instructors in human espionage and recruitment techniques in terms of the kinds of vulnerabilities that can play upon. I mean, just his susceptibility to flattery.
Then,
I went on a run on a good country road. I talked to some strong, empowered women, including my mother, and I did the right thing.
Actress Ashley Judd's story of sexual harassment helped launch the Me Too movement. She talks about coming forward and what's next. But first, Paul Pillar. He's non-resident senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. Paul Pillar, as a former CIA officer, what was it like for you to watch the President of the United States make the statements he did to President Putin this week?
You know, Diane, what the most shocking parts of what was said in that press conference in Helsinki had to do in large part with the setting, the fact that he was standing up there next to the Russian president, who is, shall we say, the principal perpetrator in some of these events that have concerned us. Mr. Trump, for quite some time, has taken a very derogatory line toward the security agencies and the law enforcement agencies of this country. This goes back a long time. So, you know, what I've heard and what my former colleagues in the national security community and the intelligence community heard, well, they've already been hearing it for quite some time. I think it was this additional shock value that it wasn't just in a tweet or in a rally in Grand Rapids or something like that, but rather in the one, probably one forum more than any others, where Americans as a whole, and not just intelligence officers, expect our leaders to stand up for all of us in our country against what is seen as an adversary amidst the sorts of events that took place over the course of the past election year.
And, of course, then he backtracked on what he was recorded as saying and tried to turn it into exactly the opposite of what he said.
Yeah, well, of course, then he backtracks on the backtrack.
Exactly.
But I think the first thing we should note was in that press conference, when Mr. Trump was asked by the AP reporter directly, do you believe the intelligence agencies of your own country, and will you, before the world, warn Mr. Putin not to do that sort of thing again? His response was not just a single double negative that he says he stumbled over. It was one of these long, typically Trumpian ramblings in which he was tearing into the FBI again and going on and on about why didn't they get the server at the DNC and what about this Pakistani and so on and so forth, not to mention a number of his other responses at the same press conference, which took basically the same line. And then you may recall that next day when he's reading from the script in the White House in which he's trying to retract and say, well, I stumbled over the double negative, he couldn't resist departing from his script and saying, well, of course, it could have been someone else.
Can we say at this point that the intelligence community takes the President of the United States seriously?
Well, they have to. I mean, that's part of their job. They do have to bear in mind, I might add, the danger of compromises of information. And, of course, we had this one episode some months back when the President was meeting with Foreign Minister Lavrov and the Russian ambassador, in which he spilled some beans, as it turns out, that reportedly came originally from the Israelis. This has to be borne in mind when the agencies decide, you know, exactly what they're going to brief and in what detail they're going to brief it. But he is the president of the United States. He holds the office. He was elected. And the agencies have no choice but to take him seriously and to try to serve him just as much as they would serve any other president in performing their mission of providing the best possible information and insight and analysis that they can.
Paul, there were calls of treason after the president's performance on Monday. How do you describe it?
I haven't used the word, the T word, directly in my own writing, but I've said that I can see that those who have used it, including former CIA Director John Brennan, and some leading columnists such as Charles Blow and Tom Friedman, I think they use it with good reason. We are talking about this country having sustained an attack, a cyber attack, not a kinetic military attack, but a cyber attack by a foreign country. The evidence goes beyond any shadow of a doubt. Once you've read that indictment that was released last week, you can see the incredible detail in it. And yet we had our president not defending, as his oath requires him to defend, this country against all enemies, foreign and domestic, but rather taking the side of the adversary that we now know conducted a cyber attack against our country. And I think it is not unreasonable at all to use the word treason or treasonous in describing this very shocking and extraordinary state of affairs.
When you look at a cyber attack, should we in the world begin to regard a cyber attack of that massive dimension as an act of war?
Well, we need to distinguish between, you know, types of war and acts of war, and they're all, I would be the last one to say, you know, we should escalate from the cyber level to, you know, firing missiles. We don't want things to spin out of control. And this is one of the puzzling things about cyber warfare, which is basically a new business. David Sanger, the New York Times correspondent, has an excellent book just out. In fact, I reviewed it for the New York Times Sunday Book Review. Which is all about cyber war and associated cyber issues. And one of the main points that David makes, I think very appropriately, is this business is all just too new for the doctrine, much less good sound ideas about how to keep it under control, to have yet evolved. When you talk about something like nuclear weapons, you know, we had the whole Cold War in which strategists and people at the RAND Corporation and the Defense Department and elsewhere evolve the doctrine and the principles of arms control. We just haven't gotten to that point
yet
with cyber.
I see. And do you think that we may have to begin to develop that whole process?
Oh, yes. And I think taking as information things like David Sanger's book and then what we learn from Mr. Mueller's indictment, this helps educate all of us in ways in which we begin to appreciate the dimensions of the problem. But there's an awful lot more doctrine that needs to be evolved and an awful lot more good ideas that we need to develop in terms of how to control this.
How big a threat do you think Russia is to the U.S. right now?
We always have to start with that background that they still have all those nuclear weapons, even though it's a, you know, much lower level for both us and the Russians than at the height of the Cold War. But Russia is the one country that has the ability, the physical ability to, you know, reduce our civilization to ashes if it ever came to that. I'm not suggesting that is the main dimension of a threat. And indeed, Russia is not the superpower that the Soviet Union was in terms of a global competitor, with which we were vying for influence and power around the world. That's not the case now. It is still a major power, I think, short of the superpower ranks. But it's probably mostly in these areas like cyber, where the rules of the road, if you will, have not yet been evolved, that Russia poses the biggest problems for us. there are a lot of other areas where our interests are at least as parallel as they are conflicting. Some of these are real trouble spots, like Syria, for example. Our interests are not the same as Russia's by any stretch of the imagination. Their main objective there, of course, was to uphold the regime of Bashar Assad. But they also have some parallel interests. They don't want that conflict to spin out of control and lead to a wider Middle East war, and neither do we. So there are good reasons to talk to the Russians about a problem like that and trying to find formulas that keep bad situations from getting even worse.
There has been some talk, pretty incredible to at least my uninformed mind, that Russian President Putin has said he would like to interview or have his security officials interview former Ambassador Michael McFaul, as well as others, in exchange for having the 12 indicted persons here by our counsel, Mr. Mueller. What do you make of that?
Well, I've been shaking my head about that just as hard as many of the other people who were dumbfounded by that have been shaking theirs. I mean, two main points about this, Diane. Number one, it would be a huge mistake because it implies equivalence between the cyber attack on our election on the one hand, and on the other hand, well, two things. Bill Browder, the American-born British businessman who was a human rights advocate and who was the client of Sergei Magnitsky, whose death was the inspiration for our Magnitsky Act. Nothing that Bill Browder has done is equivalent to, you know, the cyber war in the other direction. And likewise, certainly, with former Ambassador McFaul, the idea, and of course, Mike McFaul is now a private citizen, that he would somehow be turned over to the Russians for questioning and interrogation is just, it just boggles the mind. No, there's no equivalence at all. And then the other big issue, of course, is why would we want Russian, you know, military intelligence types to sit down, you know, with our officials to learn as much as they possibly could about how we know about what they were doing and what our sources were. I have no doubt that there are counterintelligence types in the GRU and elsewhere in Russian intelligence who are salivating over the prospect that they could sit down with the likes of the special counsel staff and others to find out how we got our information. And indeed, if you read that indictment from last week, that probably had shock value back in Moscow and with the GRU. And there are no doubt inquiries going on right now back in Moscow as to how that information was compromised. And I expect some heads will be rolling in the GRU, the Russian military intelligence. So, no, it is preposterous, quite frankly, for our White House to suggest that kind of proposal from Putin was seriously entertained.
What do you make of the indictment of the young woman, Maria Butina?
Well, it's one more facet of the influence effort. It's been clear all along that this wasn't just a matter of hacking into DNC email or anything like that. We had the whole propaganda effort, for example, through RT and Sputnik, which played into the election influence. With the young woman, this seems to be a matter of trying to get inroads and influence, particularly on groups on the right, such as the NRA and other Republican and conservative operatives. The way the Russians, and certainly before them the Soviets, have operated in trying to penetrate, you know, our political system and our social system for many, many years has always been to place bets all over the board, to use whatever techniques are available. And if this is a matter of using personal relationships, or in this case, reportedly even things like offers of sex, to try to get into, to have access in certain powerful quarters that they wouldn't possibly get, that's one method. If it's a technical means, such as hacking into computer servers, that's yet another method. They will continue to use all these techniques available.
Paul, again, back to the meeting between Trump and Putin. How unprecedented is it for two leaders to meet together with no advisors around?
That's highly unusual, as the main part of the meeting. I mean, that was the main part of the meeting. They met for over 2 hours alone. They later had this lunch session with the Secretary of State and others, but apparently that was the lesser part. I think in previous meetings, we've only had certain kind of sidebar conversations, you know, walk in the woods type things, which wasn't the main interchange. And the main interchange was with long tables and with ministers and advisors present. The fact that here the main interchange was just the two of them with interpreters justly inspired a lot of skeptical discussion before the meeting even took place. And now we are seeing today some of the result. You know, a week after the meeting takes place, the Russian government is talking about, oh, this understanding we reached or this agreement we reached, or we're ready for our military to talk to your military about the understanding that our presence reached. And yet our government, based on what it's said so far, seems to have no idea or hardly any idea exactly what agreements were reached. And they wouldn't, because there's no record. You can't rely on the interpreters for that. People who have I've talked to who have done the job of interpreting for high-level diplomacy emphasize that this is a very intense effort where they have to focus on the here and now and just get the words right. And it's not a basis for long-term memory, or certainly their notes are not a basis for a record of what took place.
So should the Congress subpoena this woman who was the interpreter for the U.S.?
I think that would be unfair to the interpreter. I think it's a matter of interpreters' professional ethics that, especially at these levels, they exercise the utmost discretion. No, the basic mistake was made in not having the main negotiating session, one where you have the Secretary of State and the Foreign Minister and the National Security Advisor and his counterpart all lined up on the tables. You've got official note takers, and there would be no doubt from the American side, you know, what was said and what was agreed to. But we simply have no basis for that now. And this would have been incredible enough, regardless of the who the presidents were, regardless of whether it was, you know, Gorbachev and Reagan or whoever. But with these two individuals, I mean, we have Mr. Putin, who, you know, we know, at least on this Russian election interference issue, lies through his teeth. And, of course, the other president is one who has kept the fact checkers busy for these last couple of years with one lie after another. So we have a cloud of darkness enwrapping what was a habit of dissembling. And so we just don't know really what came out of that meeting.
Some have suggested that President Putin has something on President Trump. What's your own thought about that?
I think when we look at Trump's overall behavior vis-a-vis Russia, there are several possible explanations which are not mutually exclusive. And let me lay out four, Diane, sort of from the most innocent, shall we say, to the most disturbing. One is his obvious narcissism and his reluctance to admit anything that would call into question the legitimacy of his election victory in 2016. And so the idea that a foreign government interceded in a way that helped him is just anathema to him. So he doesn't want to admit that. A second thing is he wants to save his own legal and political skin from anything that may come out of the special counsel's investigation that we have yet to know as the public. So in advance, he is repeatedly, consistently denigrating that investigation and all the related inquiries so that he can discredit whatever comes out of it if it hits him in a big way. A third explanation is just his well-known admiration for autocrats like Putin. And we've seen this come up in his dealings with people like Duterte in the Philippines, even Kim Jong-un in North Korea. But Putin is really sort of the biggest, most prominent, most successful of these guys who does what Trump would really like to do. You know, ostensibly a democracy, Russia, but one in which the head man, the strong man, is able to control the press, do away with his political enemies. Trump would love to do that. The fourth explanation is the one you've just raised, which is, you know, to what extent is Trump, by virtue of anything he's done in the past, subjected himself to compromise or obligations to the Russians. I would commend the article that Jonathan Chait just published in New York Magazine, in which he takes all these bits and pieces of Trump's dealings with Russia, which go back 30 years, and involve financial dealings and not just these more recent meetings that we've all read about over the last couple of years. And this includes, you know, Russian interests bailing him out of some difficult financial situations in the past. So even if we don't accept all of the more salacious things that have come up since, like the Christopher Steele dossier and tapes in hotels and so on, although I might say, read Chait's article and you can arrive at the conclusion that some of these more salacious things, it's more plausible that they are true than that they aren't. It adds up to an overall pattern of dependence on Russia that I think is more plausible than that it is not the case. So, yes, I think there's a real problem there. I expect there will be more coming out from the special counsel's investigation. I think it's implausible that we know now all the important and relevant things to know about the case of Donald Trump and Russia and what his relationship is. And bear in mind that the special counsel already is getting the plea bargain cooperation from several people who would be in a position to know, you know, Papadopoulos, Gates, Flynn, and he's still working hard on Manafort. I think all four of those explanations, Diane, contribute to this. It's the fourth one that, of course, is the most disturbing one. It doesn't have to be a case of, you know, like the Manchurian candidate where the, you know, Moscow came up with some grand scheme 30 years ago to insert their guy in the White House. No, it's not like that. The way the Russians and before them the Soviets, and it really does go back to the Soviet era, have operated is to place their bets in a lot of different places, knowing well that most of those bets will not pay off. But they could have seen in Donald Trump, even 30 years ago, here's somebody, and he was just getting into political issues then, here's somebody who has influence, who may get more influence, and he's very vulnerable financially, in terms of his personality. Donald Trump is a walking textbook for instructors in human espionage and recruitment techniques in terms of the kinds of vulnerabilities that can play upon. I mean, just his susceptibility to flattery. Well, that's something that any case officer, Russian or anyone else, is going to use to great advantage, just as other political leaders have used it for less pernicious reasons to great advantage. Very, very worrisome. We haven't heard the last of it, but I think that combination of explanations is behind this.
And what about the political scene here in Washington? What do you make of how Republicans especially are dealing with this?
I personally am at least as disturbed by what goes beyond Donald Trump individually and what has been done by those who, to be quite blunt, aid and abet what his posture has been. We see a few courageous statements, mainly from those who are not running for re-election, like Senator McCain.
Exactly.
And beyond that, not only is there a lot of waffling and kind of, soft expressions of concern, but in fact we've had, especially in the Congress over the last few months, to put it quite directly, active sabotage of the Mueller investigation and of other efforts to try to get to the bottom of this. I'm including measures like what Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, has tried to do. And quite frankly, he's made a hash of intelligence oversight, which is a very important function. But the House Intelligence Committee is in disarray, to put it mildly. And he's tried to use, you know, highly partisan, fragmentary reports to throw mud on anything that comes out of the FBI or the Mueller investigation. That's active sabotage. I think when FBI special agents are hauled before congressional committees and browbeaten for 11 hours in a fruitless attempt to try to find ways in which their personal views biased the investigation, even though there was an absence of any indication that it did bias the investigation, and we had an inspector general report that already said there wasn't any evidence of it, this is an attempt to sabotage things. And most recently now, we have some Republican members of the House trying to impeach Mr. Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, who is responsible for overseeing the special counsel's investigation and who was the one who last week announced this extraordinary indictment against the Russian officers. Justice is being obstructed, and it's not just Mr. Trump who is doing the obstructing.
Paul, do you have any thoughts that are optimistic about where all this is going?
It is really hard, Diane, to reach down and try to find the optimistic thoughts. When we had something as extraordinary as this Helsinki moment, it's tempting to say, well, this is a turning point. And you can always point to some people, especially on the Republican side, who are, you know, maybe speaking in more critical terms of the president than they did before. But look, we've had all kinds of supposed turning points over the last couple of years. I mean, I will readily admit I was one of the many people back during the campaign when the Access Hollywood tape came out and Mr. Trump is caught on tape bragging about, you know, groping women. All right, this'll do in his candidacy. Well, obviously it didn't. And he once made that famous boast that I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue in New York and I'd get away with it. I don't know if he'd get away quite literally with that, but he's gotten away so far with everything else. I think the explanation, the political explanation in terms of domestic politics, is that for his base, and bear in mind it's his base of, you know, 40% or whatever it is, it's a minority, but a very outspoken one that he's continually playing to. The appeal to Donald Trump in 2016, and it's still a lot of the appeal, was he's a rule breaker. You know, he's upsetting whatever the status quo is. So the very outrageousness of much of what he's done, well, that's just more of his rule breaking. That's what we like. And I think that helps explain why he still retains the support despite all of these things that have transpired. I think it would take something that really hits people harder, especially in the pocketbook. I mean, if the trade war were to trigger a recession that really would inflict economic pain on most Americans, then I think we'd see the, you know, the poll percentages change. But until and unless something like that happens, I have a hard time reaching for something optimistic.
Now a quick break. When we come back, Ashley Judd talks Me Too, Time's Up, and feminist primate societies.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. In October 2017, actress Ashley Judd went public with her story of how Harvey Weinstein sexually harassed her in a hotel room. This opened the floodgates, and women began sharing their own experiences. Since then, Judd has become an activist, fighting to protect women from harassment and abuse in the workplace and beyond. I had the privilege of talking with her at a recent fundraising event for the International Center for Research on Women, or ICRW. They're a nonprofit that works to advance gender equity, inclusion, and the alleviation of poverty worldwide. A recent focus is research to understand the true cost of sexual harassment in the workplace and online. Here's an excerpt of that conversation recorded in front of a live audience. Welcome, everyone, and most especially you, Ashley Judd.
Thank you.
You know, I think back to last year and the state of women And somehow you managed to do something that ignited women, not only in this country, but all over the world. What did you do, and what gave you the internal wherewithal to do it?
I said my prayers. I went on a run on a good country road. I talked to some strong, empowered women, including my mother, and I did the right thing. And it was pretty straightforward.
When you say you did the right thing, what does that mean?
Well, when Jody Cantor approached me through Nicholas Kristof, I knew when I got that text from Nick. I was actually on vacation in Switzerland. I was hiking while taking a little break from Berlin Station.
And we should say the New York Times.
Yes, of the New York Times. And Nick said, so Jody Cantor here at the Times would love to talk to you about something, and it's confidential. And I thought, this is about Harvey. It was like, finally, baby, finally. And I returned Jody's call, and we made an appointment to visit. And what I assured her is that what I know about myself is I always like to do the harder thing. I like to try the road less traveled. I want to have a non-dualistic, non-binary mind where I can understand that there are potential retaliation repercussions, yet being a named source in the New York Times and their investigative journalistic piece about Harvey Weinstein's systemic abuse of power as a sexual predator for decades, including damaging my career, was something that it was finally, I was finally able to talk about it in the appropriate public forum. Because from that moment that Harvey first harassed me at the Peninsula Hotel, I told everyone with whom my paths crossed, including my father, who was with me on that particular day, and everyone with whom I worked that night on set on Kiss the Girls. And I told the story at great length in Variety magazine. But with the New York Times and Jody and Megan Toohey's work, the world was finally able to hear. And so we all came together, you know, in this beautiful, synchronistic piece of kismet that has allowed each of us in a small way to participate in changing the world and improving things for girls and women.
Did you ever imagine that it would change the world as it has?
I'm not so sure, Diane, that I imagined that. What I imagined is that, or what I felt so securely and so deeply and unshakably, is that I was doing the right thing. It was very simple and straightforward. And I did my due diligence. I spoke to my attorney and said, okay, so, you know, when I come back from the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, which is where I chose to spend the time when the story was breaking, because I'm smart that way, you know, what kind of lawsuit am I going to be faced with? And what my attorney said to me when we talked about all of those practical issues was, Ashley, if you can't do this, who can? And so everyone with whom I spoke gave me these reassurances that really felt like grace or my higher power or, you know, Gloria Steinem whispering in my ear, all of the right things. And, you know, and I've been able to share that my mom was so instrumental, and I love being able to say in person how she expressed her support to me, because there was nothing punitive in her tone, and there's been nothing punitive about what I've done. She said, oh, go get him, honey. And she said it just like that at the
how
kitchen
about
table.
That?
Go get him, honey.
Go get him, honey. But this was not the first encounter you had had with men as predators.
Correct. I was molested for the first time that I remember when I was 7 years old. And I say remember because my mom and I talk often and openly about a time that I was sexually assaulted as a teenager in a Kmart in Franklin, Tennessee. And I have no memory of that, even though he is a registered sex offender in the county next to mine in Tennessee. And so that's so what is so germane to me, too, is that we believe ourselves and we believe our sisters. And we understand that we can heal the feelings without necessarily needing to know all the details of what happened.
But think about all the women who came before you and said what you have said and said it publicly, and yet were not believed. Why do you believe that your story made the difference?
I think we have to look to Tarana Burke and what she started with Me Too all those years ago, because the way Tarana tells her story is that a young person, because she was working with brown and black girls in the rural South, doing community-based organizing, when they would come to her and divulge that they had been molested, she wished that she could say anything, something to them. And eventually what she settled on was she wished she'd been able to whisper back, "Me too." And when Alyssa Milano, of course, tweeted that now famous tweet, you know, the tweet that was heard around the world, saying, if you're with Ashley, say "Me too." Tarana knows the exact number of Facebook impressions that happened in the next 24 hours, but I think it was something like 750,000 women on their personal Facebook pages were saying "Me too." And the beauty of the hashtag and the statement is that we can share as much or as little as we need and want to at any particular time, but we all understand each other and what we mean.
I'm still wondering whether you expected this extraordinary outpouring.
You know, why don't I just say hell yeah? I mean, it's about damn time.
Yeah, you bet. It's about damn time. Now, we have to wonder a little bit before we move forward how what you did affected your career.
So we have to scroll back to what I did in that hotel room resisting a sexual predator. That damaged my career because, and there's a lawsuit, so I can't talk in too great a detail about it, but you can read about it in the New York Times piece, which covers the lawsuit very well. You know, I was able to get out of that room without being physically assaulted or raped. But I paid the price in my career in that I was blackballed and my reputation was maligned. And I was just visiting with someone earlier today about how I've had to make peace with the fact that my economics are different today as a 50-year-old woman who's had a career for over 20 years than they would have been if I had succumbed to a sexual predator. Just by virtue or function of being female, my pocketbook is very different today than it might otherwise have been. And that's just reality. But what I can do about that today is help advocate that the awareness and the legal changes that recognize that economic restitution is an essential part of gender equality in this country, and that when we experience workplace harassment and we don't get that promotion, or we're transferred off of the more optimal shift, or we lose out on financially advantageous overtime, it hurts American families.
But this hasn't been just America. This has spread around the world.
Russian Parliament. It's amazing. The woman, the Brazilian woman who's singing, I can't remember her name, but she's become a huge sensation in a really sort of macho, patriarchal musical genre in Brazil. And she's at cattle roundups singing about, throw the bum out. It's amazing. It's everywhere. And in so many different kinds of spaces that women are occupying in a more full-throated way.
Ashley, what about minority women, disadvantaged women, not only in this country, but around the world?
Well, our feminism does have to be intersectional, and we have to understand that we all have different experiences related to our gender identity, our sexual orientation, our ethnicity and race, our religious backgrounds, and around the world. You know, recently I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo in South Sudan, and I was asked, particularly in South Sudan, where women are incredibly depressed and actively suicidal and over 60% report being raped, family planning prevalence is only 2.7%. So you're looking at, 97% of women can't regulate their fertility, and they're averaging more than 7 children. Not all of those children survive, of course. I was at a fistula repair surgery with a woman who had 7 pregnancies and only 2 of her children were living. But I said that when we women group up and we share our experience and our strength and our resilience and hope together, we are practicing the spirit of the Me Too movement. And when we mentor and sponsor each other and we form these strong female coalitions like the Bonobos have, we are practicing the spirit of the Time's Up organization.
I'm so glad you brought up the Bonobos.
My primate friends.
Well, I have to tell you that when one of my producers on the Diane Rehm Show brought up, let's do a program on the Bonobos. I said, ooh! And she then educated me. Why don't you educate people about the Bonobos?
Well, it's very fortunate that we have our closest living relative, the Bonobo, to whom we can look for what it is we are hoping to transition to in a post-Me Too, post-Time's Up society that is egalitarian, that is co-dominant, that has men and women sharing power. Now, it just so happens with the Bonobos that the alpha is always female. And
we like that.
Yes.
And they're cooperative, and there's no recorded instance since they've been observed by humans of sexual coercion, assault, or homicide. They're peaceful. That's what's normal for our closest living relative.
That's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harton, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Yuriv-Lipker, Josephine Neonai, and Ben Privett. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.